Planning on traveling this summer? Make saving at the pump part of your plans with 2x the fuel points from Harris Teeter. It's easy. Download your eVic coupon, and for every dollar you spend with your Vic card, you'll get 2 fuel points. That's up to $1 per gallon on quality fuel at participating BP and Harris Teeter fuel centers. Download your eVic coupon today and save money at the pump all summer long with eVic and Harris Teeter fuel points.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 3, Episode 5. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with WISPS Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, Director of the Tucker Center. The Tucker Center is a first of its kind research center and a thought leader that accelerates systems change for girls and women in sport. Please check us out at tuckercenter.org. Tucker Center Talks is a place where I talk to, amplify, and support my female colleagues. These are amazing women who study sport and gender. We let the data tell the story, and we talk about research and ways in which we use data to disrupt and change the world through the contact of sport to be a better place. And there's a lot happening in women's sport right now that we can talk about. And in this podcast, I'm talking with Dr. Jada Mumju. Dr. Mumju is an associate professor of sport management at the University of New Haven. She's an expert on fan behavior, marketing analytics in sport, and marketing of women's sport and marketing to women's sport fans. She published one of the first sport analytic textbooks, which has been sold in 27 countries and across every continent. In a prior life before the academy, she played professional basketball for 8 years in the Turkish Women's Professional Basketball League. So not only is she a great athlete, she's a great data nerd, and she is the newest member of the Disruptors team at the Tucker Center. Welcome, Dr. Mumju.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It is really exciting to have a conversation with you and, get my message across, maybe build connections with the audience.
Absolutely. And, for those who are not familiar with your work, tell us a little bit of how more specifically your work intersects with women's sport.
Absolutely. It was during my dissertation, I was in this area. Everyone goes through the process of what am I going to study for my dissertation? What's my topic? What am I going to do? And with my background coming as a former athlete, I certainly wanted to do something about women's sports. And so that was the intersection between consumer behavior and attitudes towards women's sports. So that's how I started looking into the area with my dissertation study.
And we would be remiss if we didn't call out your doctoral advisor.
Absolutely.
Who is?
Nancy Lowe.
Dr. N. Lowe at UNLV.
Absolutely. And, it definitely, I think it deserves more than just one mention. And she has been by my side, mentoring, guiding me throughout the years. I do wish that we met earlier, but I am grateful that, I've been working with her for sure. She was involved in my dissertation as the external member of the committee. And she was definitely involved in my dissertation studies. And I studied the attitudes towards women's sports with that. It was a scale development study, but we were able to publish 2 separate pieces. One was more about the methodology and survey design type study, and the other one was more about the implication and what it really meant for the industry. And so Dr. Lowe has been on those, helping me as well. Following that, we continued working together. I carried my dissertation study to college athletics, and I worked with Greg Greenhawg and published one with him about, again, attitudes, but it was about women's basketballs, but more specifically.
And so you were looking at fan attitudes of women's first pro teams and then now college teams.
That's what we did to start with. So those that was an extension of my dissertation. From there, you know, the timeline set really with the sport organizations pushing out pride campaigns. And so during that time, I had the opportunity to work with WNBA and with their pride campaign. And again, Dr. Lowe was there alongside with me. So the two of us worked, collaborated with the WNBA, examining the fans' reaction to the pride campaign. And
yeah, year was that again? Because that, I mean, some people just assume that's always been the case, that the WNBA has had pride games, but that wasn't always true. So what was the timeline on that?
Right. So, you know, in previous, explicitly they pushed out a pride campaign on 2014-15. So when we look at the previous history of WNBA, there has been single, you know, one-off pride nights for one franchise versus another, perhaps. But, you know, those were not necessarily on mainstream media, or the league did not, you know, across the board promoted those campaigns. So it was just, you know, market-based. Some franchises felt more comfortable. In 2014, you know, with the Supreme Court case, societal changes, a lot of things were more on the media. I think those led into, okay, I think we are more comfortable pushing this league-wide in that timeline. And so...
Go ahead. I have a lot of questions.
Sure. So during that time, we approached the league. Nancy had a connection. So they agreed to work with us, helped us with the data collection. We analyzed and, you know, reported what we found.
And what did you find? I think that's interesting. What did you find the fans' reactions were to pride, league-wide pride campaigns in the WNBA?
Right. And that's positive. I will throw that out right away. And, you know, we looked at heterosexual fans and LGBTQ fans, and we compared their reactions, right? So we didn't want to, you know, combine them to keep the impact of the LGBTQ fan reaction. So heterosexual fans actually responded positively to the Pride campaign. You know, that is telling you that we don't, it is not bothersome to the folks sitting in those bleachers alongside with others. So it seemed like, you know, there was some statistically significant differences between heterosexual and LGBTQ's fans' reaction, but it was from the practical standpoint, the numbers were really close. And so we can comfortably say that, you know, all fans at WNBA games, watching, attending, because not everyone was, you know, attending, depending on where you are geographically, they seem to be very positive about the Pride campaign. I think since then, we haven't seen the league pulling that out, which is great. Since then, we have seen, you know, other leagues incorporate a more Pride campaign to their promotional nights.
And I college and colleges doing Pride games, especially in basketball. I know that's a something that came out with interviewing lesbian coaches who are explicitly out in their online coaching bios. They mentioned that, you know, many of them were instrumental in pushing for having a Pride game at their institution. And I think the WNBA kind of set the tone. And if I remember right, wasn't there some fears initially, perhaps with the league, that they were perceived as family friendly and that if we're doing the Pride games that, you know, they would sort of off put their family friendly fans, you know, however you want to traditionally define family. I mean, that's a whole nother discussion, but you found that that just wasn't happening. So that was really positive.
Absolutely. And I think there is something for us to emphasize here. So, you know, these reactions or, you know, the fear from certain parts of the public, it is really a learned behavior, right? So if you look at the folks at a WNBA game, they are understanding the environment. It is not the first time you get exposed to an LGBTQ or a lesbian couple or a gay couple at a WNBA game. And from the standpoint of the families, you know, they have always pushed these father and daughter, you know, connection there. But with that lens, we also understand that those men are more egalitarian in their gender roles than possibly some others, right? If you only have a boy and coming from a certain background. So collectively, actually, the atmosphere, the environment, the gender norms and what they accepted among these consumers, that this was really not an issue at all.
I love that line of work. And I think that, to my knowledge, and you know this literature better than I do, that was really a sort of a groundbreaking study to look at a league-wide pride campaign and assess fan attitudes and fans of women's sport. What other things are you working on around women in sport currently that you're excited about?
Right. So a couple things. Again, this is towards the end tail of both of those studies, but Nancy and I work with National Pro Fast Pitch. For the folks who are not familiar, it is a professional fast pitch league with probably the best talent in the world, as they also field some of the international teams like the Canadian national team, Australian national team, Chinese, Mexican. So there's like, you know, really tough softball talent playing on people's backyards. But it is an emerging league. It's a niche sport. So there are some challenges. So we worked with the league. And, you know, in addition to being interested in the marketing of women's sports, I am trying to further develop my skills towards analytics. So I always try to do something practical. It, you know, expands the literature, but it also gives me a chance to give back and contribute. And that was probably the purpose for me when I decided to pursue PhD. So
you're speaking my language, Dr. Bonzu. We do research, but it has to make a difference in the world somehow, big or small.
Right. And so, you know, I make an effort to build a connection so that, you know, it's applicable, it's helpful to an industry partner rather than me, you know, just publishing an academic journal article. So with those, we actually collected, I will say, for one survey, we had almost 5,000 respondents with no incentive. So I will tell that this is extraordinary, right? Yes. Anyone who does survey research with no incentive knows that, you know, getting around 4,000 or 5,000 responses is really unusual.
I guess we could argue that maybe the fans of the Pro Women's Softball League are very avid, committed fans and are happy to be surveyed and help out.
Absolutely. And, you know, I will go off a tangent a tiny bit and then I will come back. Hopefully I won't lose the track of my mind, but thoughts. But if you look at, you know, most recent findings about NWSL from the industry partner Zoom, and they found that, you know, fans of women's sports or NWSA, particularly for that context, they are really avid and they want to support the sponsors of the league. They want to support the league. They are well aware of what's happening. So I think we saw exactly the same case of, you know, these softball fans wanted to help the league and because they want the league to grow. So they wanted to do their part. They gave us their information. Similarly, I think the Sports Innovation Group is just doing the fan project and folks like us, you know, want women's sports to grow, willingly giving our data. So
yeah, so can I insert just a small plug for that right now? So sure. What Dr. Mumju is talking about, the Tucker Center and other entities have partnered with the Sports Innovation Lab on this project, the Fan Project. And if you're listening, you can go right now, Google the Fan Project, and you can help us change the landscape of how we market and promote and sell women's sport. So if you're one of those people that are disgruntled and, you know, you think we can do better, this is your chance to help. So go and download your data.
we worked with the league, gave them extensive information. And, you know, the commissioner said, this is the most amount of insight we ever generated about our fans. So with this pandemic, there is some pause and play and all that, but I do anticipate that they will come back utilizing some of those. We gave, you know, insights on, you know, who might be a fitting, a suitable sponsor for the league, because most often, you know, women's sports start with endemic sponsorships. And what we found based on the lifestyle of the folks, there are some very fitting, you know, non-endemic sponsors that they can chase after. So those things, I think, were really helpful. So we have two manuscripts coming out of that. You know, great. Still in the process and all
so
that.
So for those who don't know what endemic and non-endemic are, can you just explain that to our lay people?
Sure. So when you think about a softball league, right? So they do need equipment. So if you think about a, you know, bat and ball company or a helmet company, those are endemic, right? So they are fitting to the sport itself and there is a inherent connection. So if I look at or refer to non-endemic, I am referring to something like an insurance company or a, you know, based on what we found, we suggested not Home Depot, but maybe some think smaller in that scale based on the lifestyle of the folks, right? So if you were to go approach Ace, for example, as a sponsor, we can still build a connection with the, you know, turf and such at the ballparks. That's really not an endemic sponsorship, but it was really fitting to the demographics and psychographics of the consumers. Mm-hmm. We have some others that we suggested. So non-endemic is something that is not inherently connected to the sport itself.
Got it. That's important because, as you know, as an expert in this area, how we have sold and marketed and promoted women's sport, it sort of modeled the men's traditional status right. quo. And there are scholars such as yourself and myself and Dr. Lowe and others who are now really trying to use the data, right? Use the data to say, hey, let's do this differently. And here's why. And it's profitable.
Right. I'm sure, you know, I hope the audience already read this newspaper article about NCAA women's basketball being profitable. It has been circulating on social media with sport economists chiming in. So it is becoming more and more to the surface. And, you know, as much as they wanted to paint a certain type of picture for the public saying that it's a nonprofit generating or non-revenue generating sport, that is not the truth. It is just, you know, creative accounting perhaps in many ways, but right. you know, I believe
we call that a false narrative,
right?
Let's create a true narrative based on the data. That's why we let the data tell the story. That gives us a concrete basis for changing thinking right. and norms and the way we do things.
You know, if I can give an example to that, and it's very recent. So I spoke at this webinar yesterday about the women's college basketball. And this was organized by social listening companies, right? So you know, it is so nice to see actually an industry partner, marketing research companies, social listening, sponsorship, you know, valuation companies to pay attention and put together a webinar, not focusing on March Madness or the men's Final Four, but they wanted to do it for women's Final Four, right? So I think there are small steps that everyone can take and will make a difference in the industry. But one thing that they showed with social media data, if I can find it quickly on my phone, I'm looking for it. But they did identify the, you know, some companies that had a great deal of overcross or alignment with women's college basketball followers. So they're looking at a few folks' social media site, right? So if, you know, Dr. Lobo and myself are following NCAA women's basketball, so we're on that group. And on top of that, they come and look at our profiles to see what else we are following and liking and all that stuff, right? So based on that, they are identifying an overlap of what are the common interests of folks like us interested in women's college basketball, but what are the other establishments? You know, the brands they identified were nothing like we see in the industry in terms of the sponsors, right?
So really, what was a surprising one for you?
So I will say PlayStation was one.
What?
Exactly, right? So that's a reaction that we get. You know, if you look at the industry and the sponsors or brands that sponsor women's sports, what we see is Olay, Secret Deodorant, Pantene, right?
Right. But always.
It is telling you that, oh, yes, right? So, but it turned out that, you know, they found video games, PlayStation, Netflix. They had, and, you know, they...
Which counters the idea that gamers are a majority of men and males. Women game too, P.S. And maybe that's an untapped market.
But, you know, at the same time, it's telling you it's not Xbox, but it's PlayStation, right? So that those are two devices. Mm. And it's clearly telling you, you know, one thing that I paused on that session is like, is there a way for us to see if these folks also follow NBA 2K, right? So because NBA 2K recently added WNBA to their games in 2020. And that's another research I have been involved with and also Lindsay Darwin from SUNY Cortland. So we looked at the WNBA players' inclusion into the NBA 2K, but it's telling you that, you know, maybe folks like us who are inclined to buy and play NBA 2K with WNBA players are maybe using PlayStation as a device and not the Xbox. There's an opportunity there, right? So, you know, there were other companies and none of them were, you know, immediate thoughts like Pantene or Always or like, you know, the things that naturally pushed or went after.
Yeah, are more, shall we say, a traditionally feminine related product lines that seem... endemic to women.
Almost, right? So
right.
You're right on there, right? You know, okay. It's like constantly paired with the pink idea.
Right. Which, you know, right. As avid fans of women's sport, we sort of, it's cringeworthy. Don't pink and shrink us. We're real sport fans. And that's what I love about your work is using data analytics to bring out the value of women's sport, to bring out the value of fans of women's sport in really creative, innovative ways. So kudos to you. Well, there'll be a link, a public link to that webinar you just mentioned that you did yesterday that I could put in the show notes.
Right. They did send us a recording. I can reach out and see if it is publicly available or if they shared with us, but I will definitely get back to you on that.
Okay. If so, I'll put that in the show notes for the listeners, because I think if you're interested in this subject matter, that seems like a really interesting webinar. Okay, so you have a lot of different research projects going on. You're currently on sabbatical, so thank you for taking time out of your precious sabbatical to talk with me on Tucker Center Talks. You have so many great research projects going on related to women's sport and really helping us change the game. So what advice would you give to young women scholars, aspiring, emerging academics, if you would give advice to your younger self?
Well, I think I will definitely say, you know, if you are studying something that's dear to your heart, it never feels like work, right? And it is... And there is the, you know, satisfaction from contributing to what you want to change in this world. So I think those has stood up to me, like, you know, stand up in my ideas that, you know, those things are important for me. I do recognize And I do want to acknowledge again and again, wherever else I can acknowledge, that your mentors matter. So, you know, Dr. Lowe has been very helpful and supportive to me throughout, you know, my, you know, doctoral years all the way to today, right? So it is an ongoing relationship at this point. But I do want to, you know, let folks know that it is really important to surround yourself with good people who want you to grow, right? So
yes,
giving you the tools to grow, giving you the direction to grow. So I do want to thank her in public right here. But I also want to extend that as an advice to the younger audience who might be listening. It's important to surround yourself with good scholars who care for your own success going forward.
Could not agree more. And it's sort of the advice that I give to coaches when I'm giving coaching education workshops to women. I said, look, if you haven't chosen your life partner yet, and you want to have a career in coaching, choose your partner wisely. And I think the same advice applies to choose your advisor wisely. The advisor matters. And a lot of the advice I give to young scholars looking to doctoral programs, you know, yes, look at the program, but look at the people doing the work that you want to do and pick the right advisor for you. And I think your advice is well taken.
You know, one thing to note, I've spoken with, you know, some of my peers, and along the years, some of them said, I had no idea what exactly I wanted to research when I started. I knew it, right? So some of you may not be as fortunate to know what you want to do, but there is still a way to find your path. So I purposely applied only to certain programs based on the advisor I may get, right? So that was purposeful for me. But I noticed that was not the case for some of my peers through conversations. Even if that's the case, I turned out to go to a university hoping to, you know, study under a scholar's guidance. Then she turned out to go on sabbatical in my first year and never returned, right?
Oh my gosh.
So, right. So I had to find my own path, right? So it happened through the connection of my dissertation chair and his, you know, relationship with Dr. Lowe. She got put into, you know, the mix, and then that gave me an opportunity. So with that said, you know, you can definitely find your own path, even though you don't know what you want to do today. And nowadays, there are student groups in NASM and SMA, and there are more resources given to doctoral students to find some of those mentors. So I definitely encourage current students to look into attend those and try to find mentors, even if they are outside of your own institution.
Yeah, that's great advice, Dr. Mumju. So I have so many more thoughts and so many more questions for you, but for the sake of being succinct and concise, we'll wrap up this episode of Tucker Center Talks. But I do want to bring up one other thing that you mentioned on another call we were on together with our Women in Sport Industry research team that's super relevant and current and has to do with name, image, and likeness. So you mentioned Sedona Prince and her TikTok video of the disparities between the women's basketball March Madness and the men's basketball March Madness, and the weight room and the food and the swag and the COVID testing. And she's brought that to light in her TikTok, which yesterday in my class, we looked it up, had over 9 million views, I think, on TikTok. And you said, if we had this policy in place where NCAA student athletes could capitalize on their name, image, and likeness, how much money would she be able to monetize?
The social media value of that one particular post is $5.7 million.
Okay, let's just let that sink in.
Right.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, the legislation and policies and legal cases with name, image, likeness, this is important stuff. And when you said that on our call, I thought, oh my gosh, don't tell Sedona Prince, because she'll probably be depressed that she can't actually capitalize on that right now.
Right. But, you know, they were talking about it at the webinar yesterday that, you know, she could trademark it and have these, you know, online trademarks going on for digital arts and such. So they threw the idea of potentially she could trademark her video. And if not right now, she may be able to profit from it in the future. So given ideas.
Okay. You heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Momju. It was a pleasure to talk to you on your sabbatical. I appreciate your time. And we'll be sure to have you back when we talk about future data analytics in women's sport.
It will be my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, as we wrap up this episode of Tucker Center Talks, be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We have a vast array of free resources and a new research area on under our current research tab on the women in the sports industry. And please check that out. It's emerging and it's exciting. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wisports.com. Look for Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport. Stay safe. Give yourself some grace and let the data tell the story.